and reviews and interviews with me. I have a soundtrack on there. And
that's BEHR. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Alex Bear. Catch her at Woodstock. Our engineer is John Shuck. Thanks, John. Stay tuned for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. And thanks for tuning in.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good morning, it's 8:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks to Eileen Miles about her new book, Afterglow, a dog memoir, ghost written in part by deceased pit bull Rosie. It explores geometry, gender, morality, evil, aging, and plaids. And at 11:30 on the Film Shell, filmmakers and organizers from the 44th Northwest Filmmakers Festival will join us in the KBOO studio. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 9 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema in Portland. Muertos PDX will be hosting its annual Dia de los Muertos celebration with musical performances, a children's story time, calavera decorating stations, mariachi, Katrina's traditional Mexican cuisine, and much more. A portion of this year's proceeds will benefit Oregon por Mexico for earthquake relief in Mexico. Again, that's Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. I'd like to dedicate this week's show to Grace Marion, who has broadcast many news programs and often read the news, who did public affairs programs, who did shows with the late Richard Francis, Dadaist shows. She did late night comedy on KBOO as well for many, many years, and Grace has passed, I'm sorry to say. And so we carry on here, but we will miss Grace. Now, on to the news. I want to do some headlines here, and a little later in the show, I want to talk about the war, the increased civil war that the Trump administration is presenting all of us with, and what we can do about it. And there's something very essential that that we can do about it. Actually, there's something that white people can do about it, and I'll get around to that. But there's a lot of headlines, a lot of things happening in the world, so I want to get to that. You may recall that there was a special election earlier this year in June. It was in Georgia, and it was to fill a congressional seat vacated by Tom Price, who became President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary. Of course, it being a fox in the henhouse appointment, you can be sure that he will be the poor health and inhuman lack of services secretary. It was the most expensive House race ever. Pardon me. Democrats nationwide pumped $23 million according to USA Today, to back their candidate. But President Trump's candidate won. It was Republican Karen Handel. And President Trump stumped for her personally and pointed to her win as proof of his campaign's popularity. But there are questions about the vote. And specifically, there are questions about the Diebold machines. They're now called something else. Let's see, what are they called? Vote check or something like that. Anyway, they're basically Diebold machines from the old Diebold types. And they have the problem that all unaccountable machines do. Well, the latest news is that a computer server crucial to a lawsuit against Georgia election officials was quietly wiped clean, this is according to AP, by its custodians just after the suit was filed. And they say that the server's data was destroyed by technicians. And this happened apparently in July. And so this has just been revealed that the suit can't go forward because there is no data. This is exactly what all of the anti-computer voting people have warned about, that the entire election can just be deleted, and it was. The election was called into question. President Trump's candidate won just barely. They were very happy about it. There are big questions as to whether it was a legitimate vote. The votes that were recorded didn't match the exit polling at all, which is always a sign. And despite what you may occasionally hear from people who want to preserve the system, exit polling is a time-honored system of determining when an election is legit or when it's corrupt. It's used across the world by professional vote checkers. And so there you have it once again, the server at Kennesaw State University in Georgia, which would have been essential to the lawsuit against Georgia election officials around the election of a member of the House of Representatives from Georgia, has been deleted, wiped out, clean gone. And that should be national news. I suspect that it is not at this point. So I'm asking you to keep that in mind. Also, to keep up on this sort of thing, maybe not that specific story quite yet, but you need to memorize just this, gregpalast.com, gregpalast.com. This is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. There are other headlines. CNN is warning that a senior North Korean official has issued a stern warning to the world that it should take literally his country's threat to test a nuclear weapon above ground. And that's quoting CNN. What they're talking about is, the situation is that North Korea is confronted by a great deal of U.S. military equipment. They're outspent by the South Koreans in a huge way. But the war exercises, and as you know, the rhetoric, have been ratcheting up. And right now, the Ronald Reagan, the Nimitz, and I think the Eisenhower, I'm not sure about the Eisenhower, I'll have to double check on that, but there's all kinds of naval equipment being brought to bear in the region. Over the last several weeks, I've pointed out that certain nuclear-powered submarines used to carry special forces teams who sneak around in little mini-submarines and then go chop your head off or whatever, have been seen in the region, and one of them was parked in Busan. There's all kinds of military equipment, and one could argue that this is merely to scare the North Koreans, but of course there's quite the possibility, especially given the statements from President Trump that war is imminent, could possibly actually happen. Quoting CNN, speaking on a visit to New York for the United Nations General Assembly last month, Ri Yong-ho, foreign minister for DPRK, raised the possibility that North Korea could test a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific Ocean. So they're talking about this sort of test that the U.S. has only done once, and I think the USSR, back when, reciprocated. This is something that was done between two longstanding nuclear states that had already entered into a certain amount of negotiation. And the whole question with a nuclear missile is whether you can launch it into a sufficient suborbital trajectory, whether it will survive the reentry forces, the buffeting and the heat, and then actually detonate. And so the way the U.S. Checks this from time to time is to send up an instrument package, which has all of the triggers and the equipment that goes into the latest nuclear weaponry that goes onto those bombs, and but not the plutonium explosive, and then check and see whether nuclear weaponry uses, among other things, self-tamping mechanisms that have to be timed to microseconds. And so this is essential to actually setting the things off. Self-tamping means that the explosives create pressure against other explosives, and they're set off just microseconds from each other in order to force more pressure into the center of the bomb, where the fissile material is, which does the real explosion. That's kind of tricky, and so the question is, you know, can it be done? But to actually, even though the U.S. and the USSR and even France used to set off nukes into the atmosphere before women around the world shut it down, that's a whole other story. It hasn't been done for decades and decades, because what's more provocative than actually setting off a nuclear weapon and irradiating the atmosphere and whoever else that, you know, happens to drift down upon, creating fallout? So this hasn't been done for decades now, and North Korea is talking about actually launching one of their nukes into the Pacific Ocean, presumably into an open spot, you know, God help you if you're sailing underneath, and then set the thing off and, you know, just see if it works and check out the electromagnetic pulse effects and yada yada. So this would, given the context, be outrageous and might set off a war in and of itself. But North Korea says, I mean, basically what they're saying is, yeah, okay, we give out a lot of hot rhetoric and we have for a long time, but this time we really mean it. And as you know, if you have followed what's been going on, they really do like to launch their missiles and they like to test their bombs. So why not put the two together? This is what we're confronted with. And I'll be getting around to that topic again in a few minutes. But I want to talk about the climate crisis getting worse and worse. From the Washington Post, a week before the calendar flips to November, temperatures in cities and towns across Southern California surged to unthinkable levels, on the verge of 110 degrees. They write, not one but two locations hit 108 on Tuesday of this week, matching the hottest weather observed on record in the United States so late in the calendar year. According to the National Weather Service, both Marine Corps Air Station Miramar and San Luis Obispo topped out at 108 degrees. Climatologists based in Alaska tweeted that the 108-degree reading tied the previous hottest temperature set so late on the same date in 1959 at the Indio Fire Station, California. This weather record was overshadowed by searing heat in Los Angeles, where the hottest postseason game in Major League Baseball history was played Tuesday evening. The first pitch temperature for Game 1 of the World Series at Dodger Stadium was a blistering 103 degrees. So this is extreme global warming weather that is happening right now. There is more trouble. A storm is brewing over Central America, and you can find that by pulling up the National Hurricane Center, nhc.noaa.gov. They think that this thing will move off land and into the Southern Caribbean Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. So we are now paying for ignoring climate change. The BBC has apologized for an interview with climate change denier Lord Lawson after admitting it had breached its own editorial guidelines for allowing him to claim that global temperatures have not risen in the past decade. This from The Guardian. BBC Radio 4's flagship news program Today ran the item in August, in which Lawson, interviewed by presenter Justin Webb, made the claim the last 3 years have in fact seen successive global heat records broken. The Today program, they write, rejected initial complaints from listeners arguing that Lawson's stance was reflected by the current U.S. administration and that offering space to dissenting voices was an important aspect of impartiality. However, some listeners escalated their complaint. And in a letter seen by The Guardian, the BBC's executive complaints unit now accepts the interview breached its guidelines on accuracy and impartiality. The complaint centered on two statements by Lawson, that the first that the UN's intergovernmental panel on climate change has confirmed that there has been no increase in extreme weather events. And secondly, according to the official figures, during this past 10 years, if anything, mean global temperature, average world temperature has slightly declined. So, skipping ahead, basically that was absolute BS, nothing to back that up whatsoever, and they now admit it, and that they should have thought about that, and they said that they in a broadcast, said that they had given undue weight to Lord Lawson's views. And they quoted Dr. Tim Thornton, "I really thought the climate change debate," he said, "had finished, and that these voices of the very rich and well-connected had lost relevance in the whole argument. It's fine," he said, "that they don't like the idea of climate change, but they are on a par with flat earthers," end quote. Which I thought was particularly well said. Now, the time is 9:15. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. More headlines to go, and then I'll get to the TOFU, the program, which is talking about the upcoming wars and the wars that the Trump administration has worsened and unleashed upon us. Something I think we need to really take seriously, but something that we do have the capacity to confront, defuse, change the direction. We can do what we want to once we wake up, and that's what KBOO is for. Wake up. Good morning. It's 9:15. Time for revolution. The number to call with your comments and questions is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Human Rights Watch is calling for a congressional inquiry into an executive order aimed at the warrantless monitoring of U.S. citizens and permanent residents after obtaining new documents that raise serious and troubling concerns about the extent of such surveillance. This comes from Common Dreams, an article by Julia Conley. She writes, the human rights group used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain training materials used by the Defense Department to implement Executive Order 12333's guidance, in which agencies are directed to monitor potential homegrown violent extremists. A Defense Department spokesperson told Human Rights Watch that such extremists, quote, may be self-radicalized via the internet, social media, etc., and then plan or execute terrorist acts in the furtherance of the ideology or goals of a foreign terrorist group, end quote, but offered no further information about criteria government agencies would use to determine potential dangerous individuals. Now, speaking for myself, this is exactly the same sort of language that was presented to justify the depredations of the COINTELPRO program when it was exposed by a group of ex-FBI agents, I think it was ex-FBI agents, who actually busted into an FBI building and stole the records and then sent them out to many publications, only one or two of which actually published them and set up the whole hoo-ha in 1975, Senator Church held court and asked what all this snoopery was going on, why it was going on. And it's been forgotten in the tide of time, I suppose. But the fact is, the CIA, the FBI, the three-letter terrorist organizations that we maintain imperial power with, have grown more secret and are much better funded than they were in 1975. They have what they call black funding, which means that it's how much funding they get, what they use it for, is censored, just as it is in the other totalitarian countries. And it's always, well, there might be some monitoring, but we're just checking the terrorists. Well, this isn't true. COINTELPRO was to follow every American, basically, who pissed off J. Edgar Hoover. And that's what it is now. That's what cops do. I mean, we plural, all of us, we have our written down instructions for cops of various types, and then we have our cultural instructions, which are very powerful and which we reinforce every day. Turn on the television, go to the movies, and see the story over and over and over. And the story is there's bad guys out there, and the only real good guys who really get results are the smirking, handgun-blazing bad cops. And the message is, be a bad cop. Otherwise, you're nothing. You're a wimp. You're not part of the story. You're not interesting. This message has been... there are people who are approaching middle age who have only ever seen this message when it comes to the humanities and the treatment of how police really should act. And so we get what we ask for. We demand... We demand fascism from our police, and we get it. We shouldn't be surprised. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Or as, returning to the article, Julia Conley writes, as civil libertarians have long warned, the government has often used the initial cover of targeting terrorists to further their ability to monitor other groups. Quoting... quoting Sarah St. Vincent, a surveillance and national security researcher, these documents point to just how thoroughly the public has been kept in dark about warrantless surveillance under Executive Order 12333. The government's authority to monitor people, she said, doesn't depend on their beliefs or what the government thinks they believe, but on specific evidence that gives sufficient reason to think a criminal offense is occurring or that the person is an agent of a foreign power. A secret determination that someone's rights should be curtailed based on undisclosed criteria is incompatible with rule of law. The government should explain what it's doing as well as its legal basis for doing it, end quote. Now think of that quote, and you know that to be correct. And then think about, oh, Agent Blah Blah in the drama 24. Would he follow that creed? No, of course not. And he's, you know, great imaginary American hero. This is what we're doing. And it's in that context that things have worsened so much with this this Trump administration. So I'll be getting down to some details on that. Once again, the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And I'll go to the first caller. Ken is on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to... talk about the hacking and polling devices.
All right.
First of all, I want to say that there's a book that's free and online, and it's called Code Red. And the author's name is Jonathan Simon, and he runs a organization in Massachusetts whose name escapes me, but it's something like Protecting Polling Data or something like that. And so the other thing I want to mention is that when Jill Stein attempted the recall in, I think it was in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, they discovered that in terms of some of the polling districts in that state, I presume this is available on her website, some of the polling districts in that site were done by were counted by electronic machines, and some were hand counts. In the place where there was a electronic count, the discrepancy between the pre-poll and the exit poll was great, whereas in the places where there was a hand count, the discrepancy between the pre-poll and the exit poll
was predictably negligible. Yeah.
Okay. Another point I'd like to make is that, so far as I know, the only reliable evidence we've had of Russia hacking any websites is they simply went in and did a survey of certain polling stations in the U.S. That's all they did. So this is significant, I think, because in the four states, which were Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and I think Indiana, that conferred the Electoral College vote to Trump, were all places, number one, where Hillary did not appear, but it's possible that those four states, which refused Jill Stein's effort to get a recount, by the way, right?
Yes, those half recounts were very telling. They were shut down, and there was
exactly.
No full and effective recount. There was no accounting for the polls that were actually shut down wholesale. People were just refused the right to vote in places in Michigan. I found the book that you're talking about, Jonathan D. Simon, Code Red,
yes,
Computerized
yes.
Election Theft in the New American Century, 2016 edition. Let's see, that's about $20, and you can get it at the at local bookstores. I'll be happy to order that for you. You can get it online. You can get it at Powell's Books, which is a local unionized bookstore.
You can also get it online for free.
Online for free, okay. You mean as an e-book, then.
The other book you want to read, of course, is Jane Mayer's Dark Money. To explain this whole thing.
That's a good one, yeah, Dark Money.
All right, and so here's something that I have been unable to do, but I suspect that you are able to do, is that some time ago on KBOO, someone interviewed a transgender genius by the name of Emily Gorsensky, and she told about how easy it is for the respective Secretary of States who are responsible for securing the polling data in the various states, what kind of control they have over actually what gets published, what gets to be the official dark data.
What is considered legitimate.
Yes, and I'll tell you that if you can find out who interviewed her and when, or if you can get in touch with her, she said in that interview that she'd be very happy to discuss it with anybody who was interested. But I want to give you an example, and that is that in the state of Ohio, because there were previous electoral differences, questionable practices, I think the Federal Election Commission recommended that the state of Ohio institute a audit trail by photographing returns. And guess what happened in the last election? The Secretary of State turned off the photographing mechanism that would have enabled a audit trail.
Yeah, when you combine all the stories, what you see is, a faking of the elections that has become almost casual. And I thank you very much for calling in with that information. I do have some other topics I want to bring up, so I'll just go ahead with that. Thank you very much for calling in.
Gorsensky?
Yes, Gorsensky.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Emily Gorsensky. All right. Now, speaking of corruption in the news, critics, according to Common Dreams, critics raised suspicions earlier this week over the $300 million no-bid contract. You may have heard about this. It was awarded to a little bitty two-year-old private energy company to restore Puerto Rico's electrical grid. The company is financed by a major donor to the Trump campaign and the Republican Party, and also has connections to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Turning to The Guardian, in the UK, the mayor of San Juan on Wednesday accused the company restoring power to Puerto Rico of threatening to withdraw its services after she drew attention to its controversial contract. Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, bless her, had demanded greater transparency over the $300 million deal secured by Whitefish Energy, a tiny two-year-old firm based in the Montana hometown and probably the Montana garage of the U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. That crack about the garage was an attempt at humor, by the way. But anyway, returning to the text, Whitefish hit back in a tweet saying, quote, "We've got 44 linemen rebuilding power lines in your city, and 40 more men just arrived. Do you want us to send them back or keep working?" End quote. Cruz then responded on Twitter, quote, "They are threatening not to do their job, which is frankly quite irregular for a company hired to work for the public sector," end quote. Whitefish had only two, count them two, one, two, full-time employees when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico on the 20th of September, killing more than 50 people, knocking out power to the whole island. The company has since contracted more than 300 workers. But three-quarters of the U.S. territory remains without electricity. Members of Congress from both parties are demanding an investigation into the contract awarded to the company in Whitefish, Montana. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic House Minority Leader, said she was deeply concerned about why and how a small, inexperienced firm had been tasked with such a huge job. And the senior Democrat on the House Resources Committee, Natural Resources Committee, Ray Grijalva of Arizona, was quoted saying Congress needs to understand why the Whitefish contract was awarded and whether other more cost-effective options were available, end quote. And the governor of Puerto Rico said he would audit the contract, but it's Cruz who has clashed with Whitefish most publicly. She told Yahoo News on Wednesday that she found the deal, Mayor Cruz, she found the deal alarming and said it should be voided right away. And speaking for myself, I'd have to agree. They had two employees. Yeah, that's corruption. Never mind that. But she added, quote, a proper process which is clear, transparent, legal, moral, and ethical should take place. What we need is somebody that can get the job done and has the expertise to get the job done, end quote. So you can see why Donald Trump obviously hates her. All right. Now, just doubling down on climate before I switch to the wars abroad and the war in our streets, which incidentally is a reflection of the speech that I and others gave at a recent, this week's Portland Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group event. More than 160,000 acres. Talk about how earlier, about how hot California is and how 108 degree temperatures being registered, hottest Dodgers game ever. 160,000 acres, to just sum it up here from Mother Jones, or 250 square miles have burned in Sonoma, Napa, and Solano counties just north of San Francisco. These fires are still burning. Another 36,000 acres have burned farther north in Mendocino County. 42 people have died across Northern California, including 23 in Sonoma County alone. Altogether, the Northern California fires are the deadliest in state's history. As of last week, dozens of people were still missing. Some 8,400 structures have been destroyed, according to CAL FIRE. Eight insurers reported to the California Insurance Commissioner that about 5,500 homes were completely destroyed, with an additional 4,000 partially burned. Santa Rosa alone lost 3,000 homes to the fast-spreading Tubbs Fire, a fact worsened by the Bay Area's already dire housing crisis. Those who can afford to rebuild their homes face a labor shortage and steep labor costs. Last week, the commissioner estimated the loss will total more than $1 billion, with that figure expected to rise. Now, speaking for myself, you heard the numbers, thousands of structures, you know, getting more than 8,000 structures destroyed. And these are the, structures have been destroyed. And these are the new figures. These will increase, of course, and it's still 108. And the fire is still burning, and these people have to go somewhere. So, as I said, in the case of climate change, Harvey, climate change, Irma, climate change, Maria, about the climate change fires, people are being displaced. We will see the effects here in Portland to whatever degree. We can't really predict that. Although, I'm going to just hazard a guess that anyone who has lost their home faces major reconstruction costs. And has money, might want to look a bit north as well as any place else and come up to Portland. So, I certainly welcome them. And just as an aside, by the way, this whole snarky attitude in town about, you new people go home, will you stop with that? What a nasty, pointless attitude. Really. I hear leftists uttering this sort of thing. Y'all should be ashamed of yourselves. Come on. Whoever's coming here is whoever's coming here. Is it a free and open country or not? Are you for freedom of movement or not? Sure, things will change around here if the place gets crowded, and especially if whole people with a whole lot of money come here. But we have the ability to deal with that now, don't we? Let's let's be positive and make things happen and work with the new people here rather than snarl at them. But as I was saying, the climate change has, the global climate change has produced this tremendous fire situation in California. I think that's obvious. I mean, it hasn't, obviously, what you say is not that it has created a fire, because fires have gone on and on, but we can see by graphing it out that fires in California are getting worse and worse. Fire season is getting longer and longer. This is true also in Oregon. We had our own fires here choking us. This situation is getting out of control, and I have to ask, what would you like to have done about it? What would you like to do about it? Is it time to talk about global climate engineering? 24 wineries in Napa, Sonoma, and Mendocino counties have been partially or fully destroyed. Some vineyards have been able to finish out the harvest season, but those most affected may take 5 years to grow back their vines. That's a $1.92 billion industry, so that's an economic effect which will have shock effects. So that is happening. From TheNation.com, an article by Alan Fetterman, in the next 5 years, millions of acres of Americans' public lands and waters, including some national monuments and relatively pristine coastal regions, could be auctioned off for oil and gas development with little thought for environmental consequences. That's according to a leaked draft obtained by the Nation of the Department of Interior's Strategic Vision. It states that the Department of Interior is committed to achieving American energy dominance through the exploitation of vast amounts of untapped energy reserves on public lands. Speaking for myself, this means fracking, which means more methane release, which means worse climate change before it ever gets to the refinery, where it will be converted to diesel and gasoline and other products, which will be burned, worsening climate change. Returning to the text, that's a clear departure from current policy. The previous plan, covering 2014 to 18, referred to climate change 46 times and explicitly stated the department was committed to improving resilience in those communities most directly affected by global warming. Again, speaking for myself, this is being done by an administration which, frankly, and this can be specifically, legally, and scientifically proven if the will is there to actually bring out the facts, stole the election. They stole the election. Now they are destroying the planet. What are you going to do about it? Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. The Trump administration is aware at some level that it lost the popular vote and that it must now rule as a minority in the style of the de Klerk apartheid regime, which died in the 80s. To that end, Trump regularly gives racist statements and gestures, you know, the wall, not against white people from the north, but against brown people from the south, even though those people are so desperately needed to do everything from road work to crop picking. The banning of Muslims, the banning of transgender people, sending those messages out there, Muslims bad, transgender bad, sending Vice President Pence to a football game just to make an ugly gesture against a peaceful request for respect, etc. Police departments across the nation have reacted with delight and enthusiasm, forming a de facto fighting block with Klan and Nazi alt-Reich types. That's a hell of a thing to say, but I'm going to back it up, so stay tuned here. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Active racism is getting to the point that the NAACP had to issue a travel advisory against American Airlines, bringing back memories of the Green Book days. I'll give more details, but I want you to have no doubt we are facing dangerous times in the streets, in our homes and workplaces. The fascist turn is too deeply rooted to be a mere fad. Now, part of the strategy used by the alt-right is gaslighting, frankly. It's their claim that free speech rights are being denied. That's part of their gaslighting. The fact is, no one has denied them the extraordinary spotlight and coverage they have received over the past few years, and especially the past few months. What people object to is the imposition of an armed, blooded death squad on the podium, posing as an innocent purveyor of ideology. This denial is essential both to the maintenance of various aspects of American hierarchy, namely whiteness and patriarchy, and to the continued efforts by those armed and deadly groups to gain political traction. When you deny a podium to ISIS, you're denying them a chance to intimidate their opponents with their known military and covert murder techniques. If I were representing ISIS, standing there with their flag and whatnot, if I was standing here with an ISIS flag, or if I was standing, let's say, at the podium in a college audience, I could point to any member of the college audience and say, well, I like your hair, or any statement. It would have no meaning in the greater context. The meta statement would prevail in that case. The meta statement would be that there's someone from a death squad standing up there on the podium threatening violence and death. It's the context of their actions that makes this true. So when a platform is given to the Klan, the Nazis, or any of the dozens of thinly veiled affiliates, people like me, transgender people, that is to say, people of color, and other targeted groups, cannot afford, under such circumstances, to pretend that a public appearance by murderers is just a free speech event. And I wonder if that has, I wonder if I've made myself clear on that, because when I bring it up person to person, I do find that there is resistance. So I'll try to boil it down. If I'm holding a gun on you and saying anything, if I'm holding a handgun, loaded handgun, pointed right at you, that is my statement. Anything that comes out of my mouth is meta statement. The crisis that you have, if I'm holding a handgun to you, is that I'm holding a handgun to you. There is no free speech. There's no speech at all other than the speech of you may die now or suffer terrible violence. This is what I'm saying. When a death squad like the Nazis or the Klan, and yes, they are death squads, and yes, they are terrorist groups, of course, specifically by category, when they get on the podium, that's it. They are saying one thing. Death or violence may come to our target populations. Death or violence may come to people of color, may come to GLBTQ, may come to trans people. Death and violence, and it doesn't matter what they take a breath and say, because the meta statement is the statement. They know this. They know that very well. They'll say anything, 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 so long as they can get on the podium with their swastika. That's how it works. This is what we need to remember. And once you know that, it takes a lot of the air out of American fascist groups. So returning to the efforts of the current POTUS to divide the nation on racial and anti-GLBTQ grounds, courts are fighting back to some extent, but Trump has an ace up his sleeve. He can start new wars, most notably and immediately with North Korea and Iran. Cast your mind back to Japanese internment during the 40s and the insane paranoia of September 2001, and imagine for a moment the juggernaut of fascism that would roll down upon all of us if Trump is allowed to start more major wars, especially with the well-armed and determined North Koreans. That would create a panic. The panic, obviously, I mean, within our own lifetimes, we see what Americans do when they're panicked by an imperial administration. They turn to fascism. They want to turn each other in, by golly. They want to suspect everyone's backpack as a bomb. It's pitiful, but there it is. That's where we live. Remember that Occupy was dismantled. It didn't fizzle. It didn't lack a focus. The focus of Occupy was that there was a maldistribution of wealth and that we needed to democratically consider how to distribute wealth and power in this nation. Occupy was dismantled in a coordinated national anti-dissent effort. And the name of that effort was the Domestic Security Alliance Council, the DSAC, the Domestic Security Alliance Council. Remember that. It was exposed in a Guardian article by Naomi Klein to be composed of the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and incredibly, the big banks that were being targeted as immoral by the Occupy protesters. This is the current context that even before Trump, under Obama, we are facing a violent and insidious elite rule that is determined to maintain the worst class division and maldistribution of wealth in American history. And that has everything to do with how much power you have and whether you can move on the issues that affect you personally. We must distribute prosperity equitably because you can be crushed when it's not. This is good to remember because I have some good news. The Poor People's Campaign, yes. That Poor People's Campaign, the ideas of Martin Luther King, which had an Occupy effort, by the way, in 1968 on the National Mall, is now reforming. The Poor People's Campaign is happening. You'll be hearing more about it in the coming months. But regarding fascist infiltration of police and refusal by police and prosecutors repeatedly to confront and charge, organized white supremacist violence, that isn't new, not at all. And it's easy to find examples of that. I think for the KBOO audience, you already know it is true that the police are chock full of Klan and Nazi types. I have some more details, but I think there may be some callers, and I'll go to Roger. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Teresa. I called right before the first caller, and so I'm still on the election hacking.
That's fine.
Okay. A book from 2008 that was edited by Mark Crispin Miller called Loser Takes All. which I'm sure you're familiar with. The library has a copy. And there's an essay by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about Diebold and Max Cleland's loss in Georgia. And it has eyewitness counting by a man named Chris Hood, who was working for Diebold. And he said in July, he was surprised to see the president of Diebold's election unit, Dob Orosovich, sounded Russian to me. Actually, I think the Russian thing is a complete hoax.
Yeah, but, it's hoax.
Red herring from the get-go. It actually, interestingly enough, it really rose its ugly head right around when Jill Stein was saying, we need to look into the electronic voting machines, and even though you couldn't really, they don't leave a paper trail, so there's no way of auditing them. But anyway, he said he saw the CEO of Diebold arrive in Georgia from his headquarters in Texas, and they distributed a patch, a little piece of software designed to correct glitches in the computer program. And they were told to fix the clock in the system, which it didn't do. Curious thing is, anyway, it was done very covertly. They did it, and they threw that election and presumably many elections since then. And the whole book goes into instances where, by different people, these machines have been hacked by various companies. And they're all owned by Republicans, it seems, strangely. And
well, as I was saying, they must now turn to minority rule in various forms, and one of them is tricking people into believing that they are majority rule.
Right, and they managed to keep this story suppressed. I mean, we hear a little bit about voter suppression, but we hear very little about the actual physical control of not only the machines, but the whole systems by these companies. So anyway, that's all I wanted to get into. The rest of your stuff is all very interesting, and I agree with all of it.
Okay, well, thanks for calling in then.
Thank you.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. And I'll just check with the engineer, see if anyone's waiting. Leslie is waiting to talk. Hi, Leslie.
Hello.
Hi.
This is my opinion, and my opinion only, and perhaps the entire cosmos. But a climate change denier like Donald Trump, the dismisser in chief, would also maintain that a hot spark will set off a keg of black powder. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Well, yeah, he'll say anything, obviously. To the point, now we've all gotten used to it. I saw something that he said. Maybe I'll get around to it. Well, maybe not. Maybe I'll just mention it now. He said that you wouldn't believe how many resources are being brought to bear on North Korea or something to that effect. And I thought, oh, my God, he said something true. So I'll leave that at that. So I was talking, I'll just leave that there. And I was talking about the new flavor of oppression on our streets, which is this introduction of the Nazis and the Klan openly as the alt-right. Of course, we have the president trying to make a false equivalence, saying that there's an alt-left, and you're supposed to get all worked up about Antifa. Which has always been there, and there's nothing alt about the left, there's nothing alternative about my leftism. I've been an anarcho-socialist for many, many years now. So I'm talking about what's happening, and then I'll get around to what we can do about it. The time is 9:46 Pacific, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we've got more of the Thursday Public Affairs, and I hope that you will stay tuned. Let's go back just arbitrarily about a quarter century to Los Angeles Times, when a neo-Nazi white supremacist gang of deputies, the Vikings, was found to exist at the Linwood Station with the knowledge of department officials. They said policymakers in the department, according to the LA Times, tacitly authorized deputies' unconstitutional behavior. In 2006, a report appeared about, pardon me, that situation in Los Angeles, where a U.S. District Court judge found in 91 that members of a local sheriff's department had formed a neo-Nazi gang and habitually terrorized Black and Latino residents. In Chicago, John Burge, a police detective and rumored Klan member, was fired and was eventually prosecuted on charges relating to the torture of at least 120 Black men during his decades-long career. Now, I've chosen this time frame rather arbitrarily, since obviously I could go back to 1870 or further back. It's been 500 years of this stuff on this continent. Burge notoriously referred to an electric shock device he used during interrogations as the N-word box. In Cleveland, officials found that a number of police officials had scrawled racist or Nazi graffiti, yada, yada. Let me skip forward to last year. 14 officers in the San Francisco Police Department were caught exchanging racist and homophobic texts that included several references to white power and messages such as "all N-words must effing hang." Most of those officers remain on the force after an attempt to fire several of them was blocked by a judge who said the statute of limitations had expired. Locally, recently, to settle a legal claim, the city of Portland has agreed to pay $5,000 to Portland Police Captain Mark Kruger and erase two disciplinary actions from his personnel record, including a suspension for his public tribute to five Nazi-era German soldiers at a city park. One of the cops slain just a few months ago by Michael Xavier Johnson in Dallas died with a white supremacist symbol tattooed on his ring finger. And in this Trump era, it's only getting worse. Remember that constant inaction by the courts and whitewashing by the media of cop violence is organized and ideologically racist. It's not a mistake, and never given the context, an exception. Remember that Portland police were assisted in arresting anti-fascist protesters by a man named Todd Kelsey, who's a member of the American Freedom Keepers, a right-wing militia. According to The Intercept, Kelsey had been boasting of his relationship with the police earlier in the day, quoting Kelsey, "All I have to do is snap my fingers and the cops will arrest you," end quote. Remember that the Max murderer was allowed to finish his beer. Remember that the rifle-toting Malheur occupiers were treated with patience and kid gloves. No one got shot until he's actually pulling his pistol out. It's not a fluke. It's white rule. Remember that, as I was saying on this program, within this month, Department of Homeland Security apparently directed Portland police. Well, I don't actually know that. Let me rephrase that. Portland police, in any event, decided to put hoods and earmuffs over peaceful, nonviolent protesters who were locked down in order to, obviously, create the image, making them the equivalent of the Guantanamo prisoners who were similarly arrayed, an attempt to terrorize the people that they put the hoods on and the earmuffs, and an attempt to give a terrorizing message to all of us who would engage in nonviolent dissent, that you are now the equivalent of the Guantanamo prisoners. So I ask you to reject the false equivalency that Trump promotes, that Antifa is here because the fact is Antifa is not here because there's an alt-left and it's the same as the alt-right. Antifa is here because there's no reliable official guard against white terrorism. You can't count on the police because they're full of Klan and Nazis, and therefore necessarily people have stood up against violence directly in the streets. But I want to talk about what you can do about it. If you're not a member of Antifa and you don't have the health and the muscle to go out in the street and counter Nazis directly, understand race well enough to talk about it openly. This is one of the most important things you can do to deflate and to disempower the Nazis and the Klan and the alt-right. Now, when I say that, I'm speaking to white people. And I've got to say also, read the feminist writers, analyze the class divide, and understand capitalism. But understand race. Understand capitalism is not just economic activity. It's the oppression of the worker to extract and hoard value. The ignorance of all of these forms of oppression is grist for the mill for the alt-right. But the deliberate and cultural ignorance of white supremacy is the flying wedge for the street wars. And when it comes to understanding race, this is what I mean. Understand the ways that white people benefit from and contribute to white supremacy every day. People who are oppressed by whiteness know the system very well. That's why I'm addressing this to white people. The continued hegemony of whiteness very much depends on pretending that whiteness does not confer constant benefits. The whole concept of race is blurry enough to be scientifically fraudulent, but that doesn't mean that it isn't useful to the hierarchy or to the political and economic elites who rule us all by dividing us. Right now, Richard Spencer, the Nazi who won't admit he's a Nazi, is touring the country's universities right now, taking advantage of the fact that white people don't want to look at what whiteness is. So here's a hint. It's so fraudulent, it doesn't even qualify under the questionable definitions of race. Whiteness is a system of oppression, not a race. A light-skinned person in Ireland, for example, is likely to be genetically, culturally, and morphologically dissimilar to someone from Yekaterinburg or from Sydney, and by that I mean whose extended family is from those areas. And the same applies to persons given the designation Black in the United States. These are false statuses, as useful as they are, for oppression. If you're Black in the United States, your family might be principally from Kenya or from Ghana, or regions geographically and ethnically quite distinct. A person called Latinx from here might have ancestors purely indigenous or mostly from Europe, and I'm bringing this up because we need tools to fight back. The alt-right spends all kinds of energy on race in order to dig up excuses for maintaining whiteness. They want to double down on it. We must be more organized and energetic in deconstructing whiteness. These categories called race are in practice mixtures of superficial behavior and appearance, and whiteness is the concept of a superior race. So why do the alt-right say they want a white homeland, when they all admit to it, that is? Because they think they are superior, and that their superiority requires a genetic purity, which, as I just pointed out, is entirely fantasy. Whiteness is a means of enforcing a hierarchy. It is a false status. My favorite reduction for this, which you may have heard before on my program, is to point to apartheid South Africa, which, while it existed, designated persons from Japan as white. It wasn't that anyone in Japan or South Africa was unable to make the distinction in appearance or culture. It was simply a means of applying status. With white status, Japanese businessmen in white South Africa could have power and agency in the society. In the courts, places of businesses, hotels, and restaurants of white South Africa, whiteness is socially powerful and essentially both almost meaningless. This is why I say whiteness must be deconstructed and destroyed, and this is your task if you don't want to be ruled by people who are enthusiastically white, if you don't want to be ruled by this fanatic minority, if you want to confront the Nazis, the Klan, and the alt-Reich, you must understand whiteness. And again, I'm saying this to white people. The alt-Reich, they know that white people benefit from their false status, and no one wants to really talk about it, understand it, or admit it. No one wants to admit that they're benefiting from an evil system, that I am part of that evil. We know that our myth of white inherent superiority and white purity is at the base of the society, and the Nazis know it too. And all the talk of multiculturalism and progress is essentially a dodge to maintain the whiteness structure. What it really means, let's be honest about this, is okay, you can have a little space for you over there, white people say, but we want to maintain our power, control, our hegemony. Don't want to change. If you did, then we'd admit what whiteness is and how it works. Whites are comfortable with that because we not only benefit from the system, but we want to double down on its violence. And that's where the Nazis are coming from. And that's where everyone who supports the police, every time it becomes perfectly clear that they are disproportionately, that's the word the conservatives cannot hear, that they are disproportionately violent towards people of color and to other people who don't quite fit into white straight patriarchy. Comfortable with those cops? Well, then you're down with the system. If you understand whiteness well enough to participate and benefit in destroying it, you can pull the rug out from under the alt-right and their police allies. And if you don't, they win. So to summarize, the white supremacists are in power from the executive branch to the local police right now. Our confrontations with them have only just begun. These confrontations are going to get much worse, especially if Trump is allowed to start a new major war or set of wars. To counter them, to end the war in the streets, we must recognize the meta messages of intimidation and distinguish them from true free speech. It doesn't matter what the Nazis say. It's the meta message. We must call out our police. I think that things have come along far enough that really there is a moral obligation to replace our police departments. And I don't want to be mean to anybody. Pinching them off. Make them comfortable. I don't care. The taxes will be worth it. We need to get rid of what we call police now and come up with a better idea. We have to call out billionaires like the Mercer family and the Koch brothers who are funding the juggernaut of fascism. It'll take a concentrated effort to confront, deconstruct, and destroy the power of whiteness, but I believe it can be done. And getting towards the top of the hour now, so one last headline. From Mackenzie Bridge, Oregon, and this is from a Facebook post that came in yesterday. Cascadia Forest defenders erected a road blockade at the entrance to the W timber sale to protest the ongoing logging on national forest land. Already, clashes between loggers and protesters have resulted in one protester sustaining minor injuries. The protesters aim to end Seneca Jones Timber Company's plan to destroy thousands of acres in the McKenzie River watershed. The road blockade consists of large slash piles, multiple cars, and a refrigerator, all serving as an anchor for a human-occupied platform suspended 80 feet up a Douglas fir tree. Quoting Scrimshaw Forest of the Cascadia Forest Defenders, "We're protecting drinking water, biodiversity, a stable climate, and ultimately our own survival," end quote. The sale is part of the 2,000-plus Goose Project on the Willamette National Forest, just a few miles from the McKenzie Bridge. Logging began on on October 16th, and Cascadia Forest Defenders has been protesting since then. They state that the blockade isn't just about stripping Oregonians of jobs, but stopping the loggers from destroying one of the last intact roadless areas. So you can contact Cascadia Forest Defenders for more information on that. 541-554-2519. That's 541-554-2519. The timber wars have started up again. You've been listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned to more on the Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland, going out to you 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop, Saturday, October 28th at the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland. The Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop welcomes all to attend this free, life-changing training, which incorporates traditional Native American teachings through stories, exercises, and discussions that are even more relevant and needed today. These workshops are conducted in a respectful way that is both healing and empowering. Again, that is Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop on Saturday, October 28th, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Food for the Soul, a benefit for Potluck in the Park on Saturday, October 28th at the Tiffany Center in Portland. Food for the Soul is an evening of food, music, and fun benefiting Potluck in the Park. The night includes performances from Tom Grant, his band, and vocalists from around the PNW. Again, that's